Imagine you're an Iraqi refugee with 1.5 million other Iraqis living in Syria. A couple of students have some tips for you. Tip number one, speak like the Syrians.
Not only are the words totally different, but you also have to give up your deep, macho Baghdad tone for that flowing Syrian melody.
Tip number two, be frugal and don't get sick.
Just don't do it.
Don't even think about it.
Tip number three, eat to remember the old country.
So if you want to eat the grilled, greasy, hot and delicious lamb meat called gus.
But I thought we said to be frugal.
And an Iraqi game is a hot seller in a San Francisco game store owned by an Iraq war vet. Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The leaders of the world's 20 largest economies met last week in Pittsburgh. President Obama announced the biggest news coming out of that meeting. The G20, which includes developing countries, will replace the G8 as the leading forum for discussions on the global economy. That means it will no longer be only the 8 wealthiest countries that pull the economic strings. Now there are new voices at the table. Countries like Brazil, India, and South Africa will have a say in decisions that affect global financial matters. Now that the dust has settled a bit, we talk with someone who can tell us what this means for the developing world over the long term. Robin Farzad is a senior writer at Business Week. Robin, it's great to speak with you again.
Thank you for having me.
So it sounds like we've got some potentially game-changing news here that the G20 will soon slowly grow to become more important than the G8. Why is that?
That is right. Simply, I think by dint of the economic track record this decade, and that the United States, via the subprime catastrophe, was the one that very nearly burnt down the global economic farm, and it was the erstwhile developing economies, the emerging world, that really kept stability and kept economic growth through this. So there's this element of, hey, look, we're on our best behavior, and now there has to be some vindication, some officialization of our status as having arrived while the rest of the world has become a financial basket case.
I just want to clarify emerging countries, because you've got 170 or so countries who aren't a part of the G8, and there are 12 that have been added. Who are these countries, and how do you define emerging market?
You have Brazil, Russia, India, and China as being the pillars of economic growth. Within their spheres of influence, there are other smaller players. For example, you have in Latin America the emergence, the true emergence of Colombia, which was very nearly a failed state as recently as 7 years ago. Now it's kind of, in many respects, it's more advanced than Argentina. You have Brazil really arguing that it should no longer be an emerging country, that it's holding its own. It's become a tremendous importing and exporting power. It's become energy autonomous to a certain extent. You have the likes of Indonesia that have catapulted themselves into some sort of normalized capitalistic democracy. So it's really all over the map, and it doesn't conform to the old, you know, either you're the U.S., Japan, and Western Europe, or you're not.
Mm-hmm. So in reality, lest people think that the G8 countries were feeling sorry for poorer nations and saying, come on, we're going to invite about 12 of you in. Really, these are countries that may be filled with trouble and struggle and poverty, and yet their economies are growing, and it seems like the G8 can't really afford to ignore them anymore.
They can't. And that's why you're seeing these economies step forward and saying, we want more representation in the enforcement and lawmaking body of the International Monetary Fund. In the IMF, which is looked at as almost this rarefied group, members-only club, Belgium and the Netherlands have a far larger voting share than China, despite the fact that China's GDP is several times the size of these two countries' economies combined.
What are some of the major agendas or requests? What's on the table from these new emerging countries that they want from the traditional 8?
You did see a pretty strongly worded communique that came out of the G20 on fighting poverty. And this is the G20, the kind of the weaker players, articulating the interests of the poor, which traditionally have not had such a chair at the table. There's wording in this about agricultural stability, currency stability, and a lot of it pulls from the experience of this economic crisis over the past year and a half. For example, I could tell you I was in Mexico City in July of 2008, just as oil prices were hitting, you know, an all-time nominal high. And people there were apoplectic because corn was hard to come by, tortillas were hard to come by. And by dint of the fact that you had so much of the developing world investing in corn-based ethanol, that was quite obviously stealing away the supply for food corn. That showed you how zero-sum immediately the world had become when everybody was trying to grapple with what to do over $148 a barrel oil. So you did see some language in this communique to bring it back on the importance of food price stability and having certain fail-safes, I think, in check to help the people that are disproportionately hit when you see a crisis like this. I think it's important to bring that in there. And it also hit on the Millennium Development Goals and debt relief and some of the other themes that especially apply to sub-Saharan Africa, which is a region that has largely been neglected by the Group of Eight.
They also are very concerned about agriculture and trade. Can you explain what their concerns are on these issues?
The United States and Japan, for example, are chock full of certain tariffs and restrictions and quotas that stack the cards, I think, in favor of domestic suppliers. If you look at sugar production in the United States, it's notoriously inefficient. We shouldn't have a comparative advantage in this. Brazil could afford to supply us with sugar on far more economic terms. But we insist on growing it in Florida and Louisiana because it's a very entrenched political lobby, and it's set up some sort of a floor on sugar prices historically in the United States. Increasingly, emerging economies, especially those that are kind of one-trick ponies that have one national champion export, are going to look for these restrictions to be brought down.
Robin Farzad is senior writer for Business Week. Robin, thanks so much for helping us better understand the new G20.
Thank you so much.
You can hear more of this interview at our website, worldvisionreport.org. There's clearly no quick fix for the problems facing the developing world, but over the last decade, microfinance has become a popular and successful way to improve the lives of low-income people. Small loans, sometimes as little as $50, can help a store owner in Nigeria buy a fridge or a farmer in Cambodia buy fertilizer. But microfinance isn't limited to developing nations. A website called Kiva that lets people donate to entrepreneurs in the developing world has just expanded its loans to people here in the U.S. One of the first to benefit was a small game store owner in San Francisco. Emily Wilson has more.
You know, like any good game where you play, but not like Sorry, where it's just a roll of a dice.
And right.
So, yeah, it's...
The owners of Just Awesome, a small game store, show a couple of customers their latest wares. The shelves here are full of board games, strategy games like Settlers of Catan, party games like Trivial Pursuit, and children's games like Apples to Apples. Above the shelves, the boards from games like Pictionary, Sorry, and Monopoly decorate the walls. The store has an open box policy, so anyone is welcome to come in and play. Eric Manch is the co-owner of Just Awesome.
Okay, so this is Thalatha, all right? It's a three-in-a-row game without diagonals. So it's like tic-tac-toe, but no diagonals. And after you place your stones, you're going to move to any open spot, okay?
Manch is showing 7-year-old twins, Asher and Zoe, how to play his biggest selling game.
So Zoe, why don't you start and place one of your stones at one of these intersections. Nope, now pick up one of your
Manch
stones.
Learned the game when he was deployed in Iraq as a member of the Air Force. The game is played with 6 stones on a piece of green cloth.
Oh, man. Oh, I was going to trap you. Wherever you go.
Well, Zoe got 3 in a row, so she won. Okay, third time, one last time.
While in Iraq, Manch escorted civilian contractors and their local workers to job sites on a military base. When Manch and an Iraqi teen were waiting for a ride at the end of a workday, the kid scratched out a game in the dirt and showed Manch how to play it using pebbles. Manch decided to make his own version of the game.
You know, I was 24 at the time, and I had never played this game, and I wanted to share it. I wanted to, like, hey, this is, you know, a piece of their culture, and we're one world, and these are people just like us.
Manch loved to play board games as a kid, so much so that when he got out of the Air Force, he decided to open up his own game store and sell the Iraqi game. He calls it Thalatha, the Arabic word for three, since the object is to get 3 in a row. Now there's a basket at the front counter of the store full of the little bundles of stones tied up in that green cloth. A portion of the proceeds, as well as those from the candy machine in the corner, go to Operation Iraqi Children, an organization that gives out school supplies in Iraq.
I'll never find him and be able to thank him for showing me the game. So if I can just give back to the entire country, you know, if I can just give back to something, it just makes me feel better.
When Mensch decided to open the store, he wrote a business plan, and he and his partner poured everything they had into their idea.
I went out into the world, you know, looking for a loan, like, let's get this started. And it was a constant, like, nobody wanted to help you. You had to have been in business for 2 years. We don't do small business startup loans. We don't help small business. You know, you have to be in business a year before we talk to you.
It particularly stung when Mensch was turned down for a startup loan, specifically for ex-military.
It was just an absolute, just a blow.
Mensch and his partner went ahead anyway and opened the store without a startup loan. But they were struggling to stay in business until Kiva stepped in. Kiva is a microloan website which allows individuals to go online and make loans of, say, $25 to support small businesses. Everything from a laundry in Lebanon to a grocery store in Ghana. Kiva has been focusing on developing countries, but recently they started giving out loans in the United States. Mensch says without the $7,500 that came from people like Ruth Ann in Nashville and Wolfgang in Berlin, the store would have had to close its doors. Even the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and his wife, Maria Shriver, thought the game store was worthy of a loan.
You know, the first year is the hardest, and it's been a very tough year, but we're sticking with it, and the loan came at just the right time, and I just honestly, I don't know how we'd be here without it.
Mensch sees his store as a community service, a place for people to come together for low-cost fun. There's a back room with a few tables, chairs, and a soda machine. 3 nights a week, he hosts game nights there, including Family Fun Night on Friday with free pizza. Customer Cole Francis Pepper stopped by Just Awesome on a recent Friday evening. The 6-year-old doesn't know much about loans and credit scores yet, but he knows it's fun to check out the games.
I just met this kid, Sam, and he's playing the Ninjas versus Ninjas game. And another guy I just met called Miles, he's playing a laser game.
Just Awesome was one of only 39 businesses chosen for Kiva's U.S. pilot program. Kiva has had great success with nearly 99% of their loan recipients paying back the money. Mensch definitely plans to be part of that 99%.
Seeing who believed in our store really is a wonderful feeling. I mean, it's a motivator. I've got a lot of people to pay back.
But Mensch is insane whether Arnold and Maria get priority on that payback list. For the World Vision Report, I'm Emily Wilson in San Francisco.
You can see a slideshow of the game store on our website, worldvisionreport.org. That Iraqi board game we just learned about in Emily's story? I'll bet Fuad and Ahmed have played it. There are a couple of Iraqi students who've come up with a survival guide for refugees in Syria. That's ahead on the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire, and this is the World Vision Report. 20-year-old Fuad and 17-year-old Ahmed are from Baghdad. They don't want their full names used for security reasons. A few years ago, they fled the violence in Iraq with their families and settled in Syria, along with about 1.5 million other Iraqis. The two joined the Iraqi Student Project, an American organization that helps young Iraqis get into American colleges. As part of a writing class in that program, Fuad and Ahmed put together an audio survival guide for Iraqis living in Syria. The guys call it How to Be a Refugee in Syria. The first issue they tackled is the language problem, and here's what they had to say about it.
The dialect will probably be the first thing you notice when you leave Iraq. Yes, they are speaking Arabic, but it's different than the Iraqi Arabic you know. For example, you are used to saying, Hi, how are you? Like this.
مرحبا, شلونكم, شخباركم, شكماكم.
But in Syria, you will hear this.
مرحبا يا بي, شلونك, شو أخبارك, شو عم تساوي الأيام؟
Hear that? Not only are the words totally different, but you also have to give up your deep, macho Baghdad tone for that flowing Syrian melody.
But why do I have to give up my own dialect? It's my own language. The Syrians can't understand me anyway, right?
Well, the problem is that the first Iraqis to come here to Syria after the US invasion were very rich. And they came to buy a lot of property in Syria. This gave the Syrians the impression that all Iraqis were rich and ready to be exploited. So now, if you go to a store and ask about how much something costs like this, instead of like this, then you will get ripped off and charged double the price of or even more. This can happen anywhere, in taxis, at the grocers, and especially renting an apartment. So if you want to save some money or apply for a job, you might want to learn the Syrian dialect. Tip number 2. It's time to move on.
Have you left Tehran? Do you find yourself comparing what you had in Iraq with what you now have in Syria?
I miss my room. Now, I miss my study desk.
I remember in Baghdad we used to go out in our car with my family.
I used to watch the whole view of Baghdad from my balcony because we had an apartment.
It was a big garden with many flowers and trees and a swing that I used to sleep on sometimes. So, I mean, I can't have these things here in Syria.
Do you have no job and do nothing all day? Do you spend all your time thinking about the fate of your country?
My parents spend a lot of time watching the Iraqi news on TV, and sometimes they spend 6 or 7 hours a day. And I think
if that's the case, our advice to you is to move on. The fact is, life goes on. Being in another country doesn't mean that's the end of the world. After all, you're not alone. So don't take it personally and find yourself something to do. Tip number 3. Be frugal.
You're now paying for rent, bills, food, and you haven't found a job yet. Just try to be frugal and spend your money wisely on just your essential needs. Here are some new ideas to keep your expenses low.
Make new friends. Being a refugee is a great opportunity to meet your new neighbors. It may not be easy at first, but with a little smile and a kind greeting, you'll gradually win people's respect.
But how does that save me any money?
Well, there's the trick. Good friends can give you advice about where to go to find the best markets with the cheapest prices. Besides that, it's always good to have some local friends you can trust. Plus, you might even get invited for lunch and save your daily sandwich money.
Another idea is live in the suburbs. You may think that most refugees live in tent cities, but in Syria, most of us live in the suburbs.
The suburbs. I'm picturing a big house, green grass all around.
I'm sorry, but no. The vast suburbs of Damascus are nothing but one cinder block building after another.
Oh.
But it's not so bad. In these suburbs, rent is cheap, and food is cheaper than in the center of the city. Plus, these neighborhoods are full of other Iraqis, so you won't be alone.
Last of all, don't get sick. Medicines and hospital bills end up being some of the biggest expenses for Iraqis here, so watch out.
A bottle of headache pills?
100 lira.
Visit to the doctor?
500 lira.
An operation?
10,000 lira. So our advice about getting sick? Just don't do it.
Don't even think about it. Tip number 4. Eat to remember.
It's certain that you are going to miss the good old Iraqi food. You need to eat some of it even if you're out of your country. You are lucky to be in Syria because there are those suburbs of Damascus which are full of Iraqi restaurants.
But I thought we said to be frugal.
Well, it's not always cheap, But from time to time, it's worth treating yourself. If only so you don't forget. So if you want to eat the grilled, greasy, hot and delicious lamb meat called Gus, stuffed in the big and freshly baked Samoan bread, you can now find it in the suburb of Jeramana. And then there's Mazgouf.
Mazgouf is a huge freshwater fish from Tigris, roasted over an open fire. It is put on the middle of the table, where four or five people sit around and dig in with their hands.
I know here in Syria you can no longer sit on the banks of the Tigris with your family, like in our beloved country. You must miss the big, flame-grilled and lovely mazgouf as much as you miss those Iraqi outings. So don't worry, your nostalgia has ended. You can go to Sayyida Zainab and finally order that great meal.
Yeah, I remember eating mazgouf by the river, watching the boats, feeling the breeze from the river, and seeing the lights reflections, talking and chatting with my family.
Exactly. What makes mazgouf most delicious is the family gathering, laughing and chatting. Those were great days.
But wait, I thought that we said it was unhealthy to live in the past.
Well, it's good to find a balance. You want to move on, as well as remember your country.
Yeah. And you need to know that we're all returning to our country, God willing. But it's not today, and it's not tomorrow. So until that day comes, you gotta live your life.
Ahmed and Fuad spent nearly 4 years as refugees in Syria, and then they hit the road again. The guys are just beginning the new school year at universities here in the States. We caught up with them before their classes started to see just how they're doing.
Welcome to the show, Ahmed and Fuad.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the piece we just heard was called How to Be a Refugee, and you wrote it from the perspective of young Iraqi refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it was interesting, you did it in English. So who were you hoping would hear this, and what was the goal of this radio piece?
Well, this idea actually started as a homework for English class. Our teachers wanted us to write out of our experiences as refugees. It was pretty exciting, and we wanted to develop it and post it on the internet as an article. That's actually how the idea started.
And what was the goal, other than getting an A on your assignment?
This is Fuad. The goal is to get more people to know the situation of Iraqis refugee in Syria and how it is like.
Tell us how you ended up in Syria.
We left Iraq after some things that happened to my father and to the family, and after the situation got really bad and there is no basic needs of life, no electricity and such stuff, and we decided in a week it's just time to get out of here.
I see. And Ahmed, how about you? What was the situation for you and your family?
Well, pretty much it was the same, but we had a threatening letter telling us to leave our house in a week. And that's what we did at that time.
And it sounds from the radio story that we heard that you really did have a lot of adjusting to do in Syria, learning a new Arabic dialect and a new culture. I'm wondering, what was the most challenging adjustment of all for you as teenage boys?
Actually, adjusting as this idea of being a refugee, this word has so many meanings, like a refugee. And it was kind of like we lost our houses, we lost our country, and we got out to this new country with a new culture, with a new social manners.
And were both your families with you? Were you with siblings and parents during this time in Syria?
Yeah, my family, except my father, and my mother and my brothers and sister are all living in Syria. But basically, the most thing that I needed to adjust pretty much was the part of study and work. So in Syria, after I finished my high school in Syria, I wasn't able to attend a college. Then I had to work to support my family who had no resource for money, and so I had to work and leave my study.
How did you feel about that?
I tell you, for sometimes I felt really hopeless and darkness all over around me. So I was working in a cake shop for 12 hours and I couldn't see like my future in the study, if I can say that, because I couldn't attend a college. It was expensive for me and my family needed somebody to work and I was the oldest son.
You both have become part of something called the Iraqi Student Project, or ISP, and for those who don't know, it's an organization that helps bright Iraqi students get scholarships to attend college in the U.S., mm-hmm. which is brings us to where we are now. Both of you are in the United States. You've been accepted into the program, and you're both going to be going to college here. Can you tell us, each of you, Ahmad and Fuad, where you'll be attending this fall and what you hope to study?
I'm going to Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I think I'm going to study engineering, civil engineering, and maybe minor in political science.
How about you, Ahmed?
For me, I was accepted in Goucher College in Baltimore, Maryland, and I'll be studying general biology.
Great. And now, we've been fortunate enough to catch you both in the middle of a road trip, your first American road trip, before mm-hmm. starting college. You're spending a few weeks traveling across the U.S. to see the country. What do you think so far?
Well, I tell you, it's just something extraordinary for me, because I've never been out of Iraq and Syria, and this is my first time to be in the States, and this is my first time to be traveling around. So it's something I really, my words can't describe, but we found not only the places are very nice, but people are really, really nice to us so far.
Does that surprise you? I'm assuming the only exposure you've had to Americans was to our soldiers in your country. So I'm wondering what you've learned about regular civilian Americans since you started your road trip.
Well, to tell you the truth, when I was a child, the only Americans I saw was a soldier holding a gun in his hands. So it was scary, and I thought the whole American community was like that. They were supporting war, and they were killing our people. So basically, I didn't like those American people. But when I moved to Syria, basically the first people to meet was the Iraq Student Project, who helps the Iraq students to get to colleges. They showed me how nice Americans are. And I remember when I saw them first, like, one of my family members told me, like, to be cautious, like, they are Americans, they might do something for you. But when I started to meet Americans, I found some people who really care about us.
Ahmed, what about you? What had you known any Americans before you left Iraq?
Not actually. My only exposure was for Americans, like only soldiers. But even now, during our road trip, we got to know that even soldiers weren't that bad. Like, we met this guy, Jimmy, who were a war veteran in Iraq, and he was like, I wouldn't have imagined that a soldier, a Marine, was so nice. Like, he was very not like what I expected. We didn't think that probably this soldier has a life in his country just like our lives, and mm-hmm. he's living a normal life just like us.
So it sounds as though your view of America may have shifted or changed some. What do you think of America now, just having been here a few weeks?
America so far is really various community. You find everything, almost everything. My first in NYC, in just 5 minutes, I saw, like, every kind of people. So it was, like, something I never saw before.
Will you continue doing radio pieces about your experiences in the United States while you're here?
That's the idea, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I really like the idea of being a journalist, maybe.
You do?
Yeah.
It's a good job. What's your next story going to be?
Well, it's going to be about like resettled Iraqi families who's living in the United States, and a bunch of Iraqi students who came with this program, the ISP, last year. The whole purpose of this is getting people like to know this project, the Iraqi Student Project, and to know more about us as like Iraqis and Iraqi students in particular. And as well for us to get to know the American society and American people and understand the different, what are the differences, the cultural differences between our culture and American culture.
What do you miss most about Iraq?
Well, that's pretty hard question, but you should ask me what I don't miss about Iraq. Well, I miss Baghdad. I miss the view that you, when you see the river and you're standing on the bridge and seeing the river and the reflections of lights on the water and how the boats come and cross over and the Iraqi outings with the family. If I want to tell you what I miss about Iraq, I'll need a whole day.
How about you, Fuad? What do you miss about your country?
Almost everything, but I'd rather not talk about them and just focusing on what I'm doing, and which I hope will be something good for both American people and Iraqi people, maybe the whole world. Who knows?
Let's talk about the future. You're mm-hmm. going to college. You'll both be here 4 years before you go home. Do you plan to get your degrees and go back to Iraq, or what are your dreams?
Well, sure, yeah. My whole purpose of getting to the States is just to get a degree and go back so I can maybe rebuild my country and be helpful in critical thinking and the way people think.
And Ahmed, how about you? What would you like to do once you get your degree?
For sure, getting back to Iraq and help this country as much as I can. This Iraq has given us so much, and we're Iraqis are known that we give as much as we take. And I think that Iraq, we're the next generation, and Iraq really needs us. So who will build it other than us?
Ahmed and Fuad, mm-hmm. thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your road trip.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you so much.
Wish us luck, please.
The music of the Mbira, ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. I'm Peggy Waymeyer, and this is the World Vision Report. You're listening to music played on an mbira. That's a traditional Zimbabwean hand piano. We'll bring you more of that in a moment. But first, the entire housekeeping staff at Hyatt Hotels in the Boston area was fired recently and replaced by temporary workers making half the staff's hourly wage. Public outrage followed, with everyone from the governor of Massachusetts to Boston cab drivers crying foul. As for the housekeepers themselves, they didn't go quietly. The housekeepers have been protesting outside the Hyatt hotels. The scene is quite unusual. Housekeepers in fancy hotels are rarely seen, and even more rarely heard. Esperanza is the exception. She's a hotel housekeeper in Arizona, and reporter Todd Melby met her during a recent hotel stay there. Here's his reporter's notebook.
An expensive hotel is an oasis from reality. It's cloistered, air-conditioned, and perfectly manicured. Everything a person might need, food, entertainment, a place to sleep, is inside this bubble. On a recent trip to Phoenix for a conference, I stayed at a place that even had a fake waterfall. Everything was going fine. And then one afternoon, I headed up to my room, walked out of the elevator, and heard a faint voice. It was coming from inside one of the rooms. It belonged to a maid. I couldn't understand the words to her song. It was in Spanish, a class I'd nearly flunked in college. But it moved me. It lifted my spirits because it was so fresh, so human, so unexpected. I asked the maid if I could interview her. She said yes. So I grabbed my recorder, and we stood outside the room she was cleaning. I learned that Esperanza Perez is 44 and the mother of two adult children. For 13 years, she raised those kids alone. She did it by cleaning the rooms of people like me. I asked Perez if anyone ever requested that she not sing while she cleans.
Never, and never this time. I worked for a long time in the hotels, and every time the people told me, oh, this is so beautiful.
Do you always sing while you work?
Yeah, maybe more easy because they pass more fast the time and more happy for me, much better my job.
Just then, the guest who was staying in the room returned. Perez asked me to leave because she needed to work and didn't want any of the hotel customers to complain. When the door shut, my heart sank. I couldn't get Perez's sweet voice out of my head. So I went to the lobby and asked the manager for permission to interview her again. Perez's supervisor emerged and noted that cleaning personnel weren't allowed in the lobby, but I could, if Perez agreed, talk to her in the employee break room after her shift ended. The rule, the one about maids being barred from the lobby, surprised me. I'd never thought of that before. But how could I not have known that? I'd stayed at lots of fancy hotels and never, ever seen a maid in the lobby or any other public place. After Perez's shift, I met her in the break room, located in the hotel basement. While another employee warmed up a meal in a microwave, I recorded Perez singing again. This time, without interruption.
Pregúntale a la noche si ha visto alguna vez.
Todd Melby is a reporter living in Minneapolis.
En una misma piel. Mi cuerpo es casi tuyo, tu cuerpo casi es. Dos islas que se buscan en la sombra de las dos, porque el sol puede mentir.
By the time she was four, Zimbabwean singer Chiwaniso was playing the mbira. The Shona of Zimbabwe have been using this kind of a thumb piano in religious ceremonies for thousands of years, but it was only the men who played it. Chiwaniso is helping change that tradition. Here she is playing the mbira on her new album called Rebel Woman. Our guide to all things music, Ishma Fundikwa, spoke with the World Vision Report's Lita Hartman about Chiwaniso.
Welcome to the program, Ish. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks, Lita. It's always good to be on the program.
So we just heard a cut from Chiwaniso's latest record, which is called Rebel Woman. Tell me a little bit about her and how she got started in music.
Chiwaniso was born in 1976 in a town called Olympia in Washington State. Her father, Jumi Maraire, was an ethnomusicologist and a music teacher at a university in Washington State. And since, I think, age four, Chiwaniso has been playing music. And her father specialized in teaching the mbira and the marimba. And Chiwaniso and her family came back to Zimbabwe after independence in the early 80s. She started playing her music, getting serious about her music.
Tell us about these instruments and their role in traditional Zimbabwean music.
In Zimbabwe, the mbira is used as traditionally they used it at ceremonies to communicate with the spirits. At these ceremonies, women were not allowed to play the mbira. They had their own role at these ceremonies, and it was only the men who could play the mbira. But it was also used in entertainment. The men would play it when they went hunting, and so it's a very, very traditional African instrument.
Have you ever been to this kind of ceremony that you're describing?
Oh, yeah, I've been. I've been to quite a few of them.
And what are they like?
You feel connected. They're really fascinating. And you see people being possessed by the spirits, speaking in tongues sometimes. And things could be going wrong in a family, for instance. And then, you know, just to appease the spirits, they will do, they'll have a ceremony like this.
And can you see the roots of that, the threads of that in current popular music?
Well, you know what? When people go to listen to people like Thomas Mapfumo, for instance, when a lot of people go to these gigs, they're like, well, you know, we're going to Ebira. I think the music has done a lot in conscientizing, especially the urban people, especially the youth, about tradition, because then people start asking questions. What is going on here? You should see the number of kids today who are learning to play the mbira, whereas before it was looked upon as dismissed as one of those primitive instruments and everybody wanted to play the guitar. But right now there's a rush of all these kids trying to play the mbira because of people like Chuoniso, because of people like Thomas Mapfumo, people like Stella Chiweshe. It has become acceptable. It has become fashionable to play the mbira.
How did it come about that Chiwoniso learned to play it? How did she break through that barrier?
By the time that Chiwoniso came back to Zimbabwe, there were already a few women who were playing the mbira. We have women like Stella Chiweshe, Beulah Jgoko, who started playing the mbira. And I think in the beginning it was like, wow, what do you think you're doing? You're not supposed to do that. But these were real pioneers. For people like Chiwoniso, I think it was much easier because these people had cleared the way for her.
We are going to listen to an example of Chiwoniso's mbira playing. It's called Neme Musasa. Can you tell us a little bit about this song, Ish?
Neme Musasa is a traditional song. It's like a standard that everybody who, any wannabe mbira player has to know how to play Neme Musasa. Of course, initially it was just played with the mbira and maybe with the hosho, the rattles. But here it's there's a lot of Western instrumentation as well.
Okay, let's hear it. Dish that Chiwoniso decided to go back to the country of her family's origin. What did she get up to musically there?
Chiwoniso has collaborated with people from all over the world, really. And with her being born in the United States, I think it opened up a lot of barriers for her. And growing up, she also told me once that, you know, it wasn't just mbira music in their home. It wasn't just African or Shona music. There was everything. There was James Brown. There was Sly and the Family Stone. There was Aretha Franklin. They listened to everything. And Chiwoniso, I think one of her breakthrough moments was when she was with a group called A Piece of Ebony, which was a local hip-hop band that did extremely well.
We're going to listen to a tune from A Piece of Ebony called Vadzimu. You can really hear that hip-hop and rap in there big time.
Allons tout le monde, allons aux discothèques. Voulez-vous en France, voulez-vous en Afrique? Voulez-vous me voir, voulez-vous que je m'explique? Allons. Allons tout le monde, allons aux discothèques. Voulez-vous en France, voulez-vous en Afrique? Voulez-vous me voir, voulez-vous que je m'explique? Allons.
What's different about her style of music versus what would be considered really straight traditional music?
Traditional music, traditional Zimbabwean mbira music is, it would be like just the mbira, the voices, and maybe the hosho, which is the rattles, and a lot of singing. It's a kind of music that would get you into a trance. It can get very deep and very sublime, you know?
So Ish, tell me the different languages that Chiwoniso sings in.
Chiwoniso sings primarily in Shona, because her music is, or the roots of her music are Shona. About 85% of the people in Zimbabwe speak Shona. And then she also sings in English.
Okay, let's listen to a track from her latest release, Rebel Woman, called Pomeromo.
Well, that's a typical example of Mbira music. You just heard a drum there and the voices, you know, Chiwoniso and some men in the background. And that's typical Shona Mbira music. And that song is also a traditional song called Pomeromo, about a woman called Haruna with a big mouth. And that's the music in its almost purest form. And sometimes, you know, that's what I really want to listen to when I'm at home and not out dancing.
So, Ish, how has Chiwoniso's music continued to evolve over the years?
I think Chiwoniso's music has taken so many twists and turns because we listen to the hip-hop stuff and then we listen to some of the stuff from her earlier album, and she's been with so many bands, and even lately as she travels, she's talking about collaborating with people from other parts of the world, adding various instruments, more instrumentation to her music. So I don't think we can say that what we are listening to is the final product. I think she's still a work in progress. Chiwoniso is only 33, so I think there's a lot more to come from her.
You've met her. Can you tell us what she's like in person and what people in Zimbabwe think about her?
She's a real wonderful person. I've interviewed her a few times. I've been to her performances, and I've been to some very intimate performances where we were at friend's house, mutual friend's place, and she brought along Mbira and just started jamming, just started playing by herself. And she's really driven by her music. Like I say, there's still a lot to come from this young woman.
We're going to go out on a song that actually is pretty upbeat, and maybe you could tell us what the title means?
Nguwa Yekufara means time to be happy. You know, what she's saying here is that what she's saying is that the time to be happy is more important than the time to be sad. And hey, let me get up and dance because it's time to be happy. Ndiyo nguva yangu rega zvakadaro nguva yemafaro siyandi tambe inguva yangu.
Something to carry people through the troubled times, at least.
Absolutely. I mean, you see a lot of that in Zimbabwe at the moment. When people go to live gigs, it's like they check their troubles at the door.
You know, we don't really necessarily think of people going out, celebrating, partying, seeing pop concerts.
Zimbabweans still go out and have fun when they can afford to. And it's like there's all these challenges that we're facing in this country at the moment. But a lot of the times people say, okay, maybe it's Saturday night tonight, we're going out. And they check their troubles at the door and go in and have a good time, and they'll deal with whatever comes tomorrow, when tomorrow comes.
Let me practice the little Shona that I know and say, Ndotenda Shamwari. And can you translate for us, please? What did I just say?
Yeah, what you just said is, thank you, my friend. And Neni Ndotenda, I thank you too.
Mafundukwa is our world music tour guide. He spoke to us from his home in Harare, Zimbabwe. And we'll let that Mbira music play us out today. Meanwhile, let me remind you that we have slideshows and blogs on our website, worldvisionreport.org. We also have details on how to become a friend of the World Vision Report on Facebook. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. And I'm Peggy Waymire.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization. Thank you.